Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Michael Dresser Show. There's no topic this program is afraid to address or investigate, whether it be social, political, or current events, including some very sensitive cultural issues of today. The views expressed by the host, guest, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views of this station. Now, step into the realm of clarity with your host, Michael Dresser.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to the Michael Dresser Show. Hopefully, that's a good word, and she hasn't appeared yet. But Dr. Susan Maples is going to be here. Practiced dentistry for 27 years. Is the author of Blabbermouth, 77 Secrets Only Your Mouth Can Tell You to Live a Healthier, Happier, and a Sexier Life. As a top innovator in U.S. dentistry, she believes that the mouth can reveal signs of more serious health conditions, including heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, respiratory disease, among so many others. She's a member of the American Dental Association, the Michigan Dental Association, the American College of Dentists, and the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry. And Susan speaks to dental groups throughout the country in areas of leadership, team building, advanced case planning, and acceptance, relationship-based target marketing, and growing healthier kids in your dental practice. As a lifelong student under some of the most renowned teachers in her field, she successfully blurred the lines between work and play. Enhancing her education is not just a responsibility she holds dear, but a passionate hobby. And let's see if we can get her in here. And by the way, some of the things that we don't look at when it comes to your mouth, very important, some of these, more bleeding when brushing or flossing is a possible health threat of about type 2 diabetes. Eroding enamel is a possible health threat of acid reflux, throat cancer. Pregnancy gingivitis is a possible health threat of preterm delivery or stillbirth. And how about gum disease? Gum disease is a possible health threat of erectile dysfunction. And so floss, or to be flaccid, some mouthwash may actually contribute to oral cancer. Peritonitis is a possible health threat. And also, oh, there she is. Okay, we can get this right now and say. Hi, Susan, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Oh, my pleasure. I just went through and I went through some of your talking points from the secrets, and I just got a fix for all the problems that somebody has with their mouth. How's that? No good, huh? I did the intro so everybody knows what we're going to be talking about and also the name of the book. But most importantly, I started out with bleeding when brushing or flossing, the eroding enamel, pregnancy, gingivitis, etc. I really believe, after all the years of talking to people and doing interviews, Susan, most people have no idea how critical the health of your mouth is to the rest of your body, emotions, physically and intellectually.
Well, that's why the book is really there to raise public awareness of this very interesting situation. Because 30 years ago, when I graduated from dental school, I'm going to tell you, we didn't know either. We really thought the mouth was its own little secret entity. We didn't know how it communicated with the rest of the body, which right now I could feel like, my gosh, how did we not know that? But it's so interesting now because we can look in the mouth and not only see the ramifications of what oral disease does on the rest of the body, but we can also see the effects of systemic health problems show up in the mouth. So we have clues and secrets of, you know, the idea that they may have sleep apnea or acid reflux or chronic systemic inflammation from something they're eating that isn't agreeing with them, and the list goes on. So...
Yeah, and by the way, one of the things that you talk about, and I think it's extremely important, this is, I'm going to read it, so it's not coming from me, but the same bad bacteria that comes from tooth decay and gum disease is also a factor in the top five killers: heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, respiratory disease, etc. Now, how does the average person, and let's face it, somebody doesn't come to the dentist once a month, you know, If you get them in there at least once a year, we're lucky. But what do we do? How do we notice these things, and what's our first step?
Well, so here's an interesting idea. It's weird to think about this, but we have more bacteria living on us and in us than all human cells by a factor of 10. We're literally a traveling microbiome, like Pigpen in the old Snoopy's comics, right? But we have in our mouth, we've identified about 700 different strains. Now, obviously, there's billions of bacteria living there, but about 700 different strains, and only a few of them that we've identified are really quite dangerous. And so we don't know that if we're carrying those particularly dangerous bacteria. One of the things that we think about is, oh, it's simple to prevent gum disease, brush and floss, but we don't even think about the transmission of bacteria from one person to another through saliva, et cetera, as well as, of course, viruses, which is another subject altogether. But one of the things we can do is, of course, take meticulous care of our teeth, be seeing a dentist regularly so that we can have early disease diagnosed and get it treated when needed. And the treatment has gotten more complicated because we have to take a look at, is this person diabetic? Is this person immunocompromised? Is this person, do they have acid reflux in the area? What is the pH of the mouth? What particular bacteria are there? How do we eradicate this disease in this person? Because if not, those dangerous bacteria actually penetrate the bloodstream, swim through the body, and find a home in vessels. In other words, the artery wall, which is weak and penetrated, just like plaque from cholesterol goes into the artery wall, these bacteria actually burrow into the artery wall, make a little nest, make babies like a little pimple, and then burst. And when they burst, there's a thrombosis or a clot. And that's what a heart attack and stroke is. So now we've identified lots of patients with stroke and heart attack. A huge percentage, actually, of patients with stroke and heart attack that don't come from atherosclerosis. In fact, no atherosclerotic vessel there. They take the clot out, they take a look at what's in there, and they can identify the bacteria with DNA testing teeming with oral bacteria that came from the mouth. So that's kind of how we know. And what makes
Okay, Susan,
these...
let me hold you up for a minute. Let me hold you up for a minute.
Sure.
Let me ask you this question because I think it's important. You've studied this. You've researched it. I mean, you live this. But how many other dentists, not in the mouth, but how many other dentists actually look at the mouth the way you're looking at the mouth? Is this something that's starting to just gel within their practice? Or is this something that a lot of dentists realize that there's a problem, but they don't know about the depth that you're discussing right now?
Well, both. Here's the deal. I was hired by a company, a Fortune 500 company called Henry Schein. It's the largest distributor of goods and equipment in dentistry. And they are way on top of this in terms of trying to get the word out. So I actually travel around the country every Thursday night. I'm on a plane doing seminars for dental teams around the country. And they've estimated that only 1% to 2% of all dental practices are practicing anything related to total health. The good news is most dental offices have heard about this link between gum disease and heart attack and stroke. But to me, that's just one small piece of this oral systemic link. You know, we're really underachieving in the areas of being able to look in there and say, gosh, how do we screen for diabetes? How do we know? Even hypertension. I mean, we can take a blood pressure, but how do we look at somebody and be able to tell, boy, they have all the signs there of uncontrolled hypertension, and we really should be looking for that. Testing saliva.
Let me hold you up again. Hold you up again, only because I want to make sure the audience gets this, all right? So in essence, but see, there's an area with the hypertension and the rest of it that as a dentist you're not going to work on. I mean, that's, you know, the medical doctor, et cetera. Now, you can identify these things, but then again, too, what I'm hearing, which would be a wonderful idea if you had offices that have the dentist and the medical doctor working together so you can jointly address the issues and there can be a fix.
Absolutely. I'll tell you that physicians look right past the lips to the throat. And if there are physicians listening, they're shaking their head, yep. They're not really trained to look in the mouth for the intricacies that we are. And we do need to use the mouth as a window to the rest of the body and communicate with the physicians and work together. The other cool thing is that if you think about it, dentistry is sort of the last bastion of prevention in the sense that we have these regular preventive six-month relationships established. By the way, that six-month frequency was established by an old toothpaste commercial in the 50s that didn't really have much to do with anything. There was no research. And so these preventive
Which commercial was it?
I think it was a Pepsodent commercial. It said, brush your teeth twice a day and see your dentist every 6 months.
Yeah, by the way, if I did see it, I wouldn't admit to it, but go ahead.
Right. Anyway, these preventive relationships, we as dentists and the public thinks that we are preventing disease by getting these six-month relationships, and the truth is we're not really preventing decay or gum disease or cancer. We're seeing rates of those go up. But we do have an opportunity to prevent a whole lot of other things, as well as those, if we're willing to address root cause and work with patients on facilitating lifestyle behavior change, which is not happening in the medical care system to the frequency that we'd like. Right now, we're kind of in a little bit of a sick care situation where we go when we're sick and we end up with a medication or a solution to a particular problem rather than addressing the root cause. And in a dental office, you have your hygienist and your dentist, you really have 50 minutes or an hour, and there's time to dialogue and talk about what's causing some of these things and how do we turn the ship around while we're still healthy enough to get out, you know, and reverse some of these things.
You know, a long time ago, many, many years ago, where I was living, there was a dental practice that brought me in to manage the place for a while to get everybody on track. And none of everything that you're talking about was ever addressed. They didn't know.
Mm-hmm. No.
They just literally didn't know. And very important, because the mouth in and of itself, that's where it all starts. You eat something, it turns to chemicals anyways, and it goes to certain parts of your body. And if it's the wrong kind of food, or if there's a blockage or a disconnect somewhere, it doesn't go there, and then the problems start. So realistically, the mouth is the beginning of everything.
Let me give you another interesting thought here. Our food supply has become highly acidic and full of sugar. And both of those destroy enamel in this way. The bacteria that live there, called strep mutans, that's transmitted from mothers to babies that makes cavities, it eats sugar and produces acid. Then we get acidic beverages on top of that. So not only do the sodas and all the beverages have sugar in it, but they're highly acidic. And then when people suffer from obesity-related lifestyle illnesses, they're often on a number of medications, and the medications dry up the mouth. The mouth saliva is the best remedy for acid attack. So when we take away the saliva, all of a sudden we have this very acidic environment, and we start losing tooth structure, both from erosion of enamel and cavities or caries as a disease. So even the age-old disease of caries or cavities has changed in what we understand and gotten much more challenging for each of us to even manage. And tooth decay is awful. I mean, 51 million school hours are lost every year from children. It's the number one disease affecting children in the U.S., the number one reason for kids being hospitalized. It is awful.
Well, you know, when we really come down to it, there should be classes taught in the schools about this, just to get people prepped for when they get out and they're on their own, or at least for parents. Because somebody as a parent does not necessarily mean they have, you know, all the wherewithal and the tools to fix anything that's going on out there. Obviously, no. So there should be classes, because you're right. There's hundreds of millions of people to reach out there, and it's not the easiest job in the world.
I think the very same thing, Michael. In fact, in our office, we have what we call the hands-on learning lab. Every child at every visit does science experiments related to total health or oral health. And what's interesting is over the course of 18 years doing 60 science experiments, they get it. like listening to someone teach and tell isn't working on these kids. We need to have their hands on it. They need to take a little
engagement.
Powdered. Yes, yes. And when they get excited about learning it. And we've seen huge changes in families where kids can drive the change when we put the kids in the driver's seat. But what's happened is that our adults also want the science experiments now because they're like, why are we not getting it? So we've kind of rearranged some things to try to do adult learning through experiential learning too. And I made a kit available in dental offices for dental offices to purchase through this company, Henry Schein. It's called the Hands-On Learning Lab Kit, and it helps dental practices upstart these science labs so that we can help them learn it, because I don't think anybody does real well. Like, if you were going to sit in front of a computer, would you rather have your hand on the mouse or watch someone else do it? I mean, we're just better at experiential learning. So I agree with
you.
There should be. Yep.
Yeah, and the other side of that is this. When let's go back to engagement for a moment. If I get experiential learning, that means I become part of it. Based on what I've learned, and if I'm active in it, I'm going to want to see a good end result because I'm engaged. I'm creating this thing. I'm responsible for what happens at the end result. But if I'm watching somebody do it, if I'm learning, you know, if it's in a book, it's information only, I'm going to lose 80% of it, if not more than that. So I think what you're doing is brilliant because it causes the kids and hopefully the parents with the experiential learning to actually become part of the program itself, and based on what they do or they don't do has to do with the success of how it's going to turn out.
I'm going to tell you, as a child, I was born fairly unhealthy, really unhealthy. I had two parents who were smokers, and I was the sufferer of a lot of asthmatic problems. I was born in an oxygen tent, hospitalized 7 times under the age of 12, and I had one physician one day turn my life around with some hands-on learning. And I can tell you, we make a big difference in kids' lives. And what's exciting for me is that now 7 of my young patients are in dental school currently. And I just wrote 4
Wonderful.
More applications. Yeah, it's really cool to see them get it and really sort of, you know, champion their health and then decide to want to go on and do that as well. So that's been really fun as an aside. We're kind of way off track on the book, but I love that you asked.
Yeah, no, but, you know, because when you really come down to it, it's if you could go back. And when I say you can go back, one of the things that would stop kids from smoking or parents from smoking, I walked into a market last night, and cigarettes were $8.45 a pack. $8.45 a pack. Now, when I was a kid, I smoked. We smoked, you know, 3-4 packs a day. But in those days, it was 18 cents a pack. You know, it was affordable. But if you think about it, if you took what cigarettes cost today and you brought it back 20, 30, 40 years ago, there would be a lot of people who wouldn't be smoking. But, you know, they still are today. And I think when you really come down to it, it all has to do with the book, everything that we're talking about, because when you come down to it, before you got here, I went through some of the talking points that we'd be discussing. Mm-hmm. We covered a lot of it, which has to do with the mm-hmm. book. So, mm-hmm. yes, it does tie back to the book, and the most important thing is that that if we really, truly understand the relationship of the gums and the teeth and the mouth to the rest of the body mm-hmm. and how you're going to live your life, I think would save lives out there.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you mentioned cigarettes. That's a major addiction, and you lose your teeth from it. It really mm-hmm. interesting commercial now they have on, I saw it on the internet, where a guy goes into a convenience store to buy a pack of cigarettes, and the guy puts his money down and says, that's not enough, and he hands him an extraction forceps, and the guy pulls his own tooth and puts it out on the counter. Like, I think the word's starting to get out. Pretty graphic.
Yeah.
But the fact is they do, and of course, oral cancer, and oral cancer is hugely on the rise because of HPV infection from oral sex, which is growing like leaps and bounds along with, you know, tobacco-related chemicals. We're seeing a big increase in oral cancer, and by 2020, we're going to have more oral cancer in our country than cervical cancer, which is just sad. That is a disease.
I hate to do this, but we've just about run out of time. You know, we could discuss this all night, obviously. And,
well, thank you so much.
Yeah, one thing, I want to get your website where we can get the book, but one thing before we close this off, that every profession has its own language. And I think one of the biggest problems that we have, and I learned this years ago, I stopped talking to myself about 20 years ago and started talking to an audience. And I really believe when you come down to it with patience and learning and teaching, it's sitting back and saying, how do they take it in? What are they hearing based on what I'm saying? Because you've got three parts of a word. You've got the literal part of the word, and you have the underlying meaning, and you also have the state of mind of the receiver based on how they're feeling at the time they hear it, good, bad, or indifferent. I could walk into the room, you got a new outfit on, you're in a good mood, I say, great outfit. And I walk into the room, you got the same outfit on, and you're in a rotten mood, and I say, great outfit. And your response is, oh, yeah, what does that mean? But that's the point when you're dealing with it. It's that communication. Okay, website we can find you at.
Well, let's see. How about Blabber? If you want the book, go to blabbermouthbooks.com or Amazon.
Okay.
And my website is drsusanmaples.com. Maples like the sugar, unfortunately. M-A-P-L-E-S.
Yes.
Yeah. And also hands-onlearninglab.com if you're interested in seeing how the hands-on learning component of that fits in.
Great. And by the way, if anybody missed your website, it's up on ours right now, so they can come back and check it out. And Susan,
one more
thank
thing,
you so
Dr.
Much
Susan Maples.
Oh, sure.
Dr. Susan Maples speaker.com if you're ever interested in a health-oriented speaker. I'd love to be in your area.
Wonderful. Susan, thank you so much.
You are very welcome. Thanks for asking.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Seems like to me, like I always had, could be, should be, making me glad. Why am I blue? It's up to you to explain. I'm thinking maybe, baby, I'll go away someday, some way. You'll come and say it's you I need, and you'll be pleading in vain.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to the Michael Dresser Show. Chris Woodbine with us, CEO of Five Medicom, an advertising strategy and brand advisory firm focusing on B2B brands, business to business. He helps clients, listen very closely, people power their brands, advising them on strategy, messaging, communications, and tactical implementation in the marketplace. Chris has worked with many of the world's leading companies in medical devices, building products, chemicals, pharmaceuticals, agribusiness, and other industries. Chris is the author of three books now, including The People-Powered Brand, that's a blueprint for a B2B brand and culture transformation. And he's a graduate of Butler University and resides in Carmel, Indiana. And let us say, Chris, I welcome to the show.
Michael, a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. I think this is so critical. You know, in today's world, there's so much competition out there. And more than just 20, 30 years ago, you had competition with three or four other businesses that were like you. Now you got hundreds of thousands of them out there, and you've got the Internet and social media, and it's a whole different world. So very important to set yourself above and above, beyond the crowd. And I think more important than what you're dealing with is the brand to customers. It's called that certain something that makes you special, something that somebody's going to remember. But anybody can do a brand, but when you tie it with your customers, to your customers, all of a sudden they're part of that brand.
No question about that, Michael. And you mentioned something very, very interesting, that it is so easy to copy things today, whether it be a product or the way your website looks or the words or colors you use. Very, very simple. But what is nearly impossible to copy is the way you behave and your culture as a company. And when you use that, the company's behaviors of its people and the culture to power and drive your brand, you're creating something that is very unique in the marketplace, is very hard to copy, is much more permanent, and it affects the entire enterprise inside the company and touches everybody outside the company as well. So what we're finding is that companies are being drawn to this method because it is so easy to copy and mimic other people's brands. And this is a bit of a secret weapon that companies can use to make them quite different in the marketplace and with their people as well.
No, absolutely. And it's really one of the things that we have forgotten, Chris, and it's been probably 5 or 6 or 7 years now, walk into the market. You know, it's associate number 342.6, and they talk to you and they say, how are you today? And they're not even looking at you. And I'm going to tell you a story that I swear it's true. And I will never forget this story. It was real quick. I was calling somebody. It was a business call. And I called up and I said, is so-and-so in? I got the receptionist. And she said, yes, he is. May I ask who's calling? I said, his mother. And she said, how are you? And I said, I'm fine. Chris, she put me through. I don't sound like anybody's mother, I promise you.
But it sounds like she wasn't paying attention, Michael.
No, of course not. Yeah. And tying that brand, now, if I was somebody else and didn't know any better, that would have been a total turnoff.
It would have been a total turnoff, and I think people can see through that. You saw through it. Now, that's pretty simple. Just about anybody could see through that one. But I think your point was an interesting one. You said she wasn't listening, and I think we can all feel that as consumers, whether we feel like a company listens to you. And, you know, that shows up in their products and how they answer the phone and the way they go to market and their advertising, everything. The customer can tell, did this company really listen to me? And if so, we can think of products that we love and enjoy buying. And I think we get the feeling that, you know what, they do listen. And really, that's some of the method that we Bay-powered brand approach is to listen to customers. And we actually say there's two groups of folks you need to listen to when you're building a people-powered brand. One is your employees. What's it about inside this company? And then talk to your customers or people who should be your customers who maybe buy from other people.
Sure.
And understand what their world's about. And when you can get the folks inside the company to understand what the folks outside want and need and will buy, you're really in a good starting place to get the people to align now the way they act, their behaviors, with what the company, what the customer wants. That's the real essence of the people-powered brand method.
Now, by the way, another quick story about people power, quote-unquote, and having the engagement from the inside out, from what you're talking about. There was a company last November that brought me in to do some work for them. And they had about 60 people in the company. They owned the building, and they had 2-3 agents out in the field. And their first line of defense, they have people on the phones calling their prospective client to see if they can get them, you know, to buy their service products, et cetera. So I worked with the first division first, and I walked in, I sat down, and I was in the conference room. I said to the guys, you got a pitch? And they said, yes. So I said, well, let me hear it. And one of the guys did it for about 30 seconds, and he said, okay, hold up. And I walked out of the conference room, went over to the receptionist desk and asked the receptionist if she could help me. She said, yes. She followed me into the conference room, and I said, I didn't say pitch her. I said, do it to her. So she had no idea what was coming. And he pitched her for about 20 seconds, 30 seconds. I stopped him, and I looked at her, and I said, what did he just say? And Chris, her answer was, I don't know. And I did that in every one of the divisions, and it's the same thing. One of the most important things, and I'm 100%, 3,000% behind you in what you're talking about here. One of the most important things is a communication, commonality of communication within that business, that's that first step to be able to reach out to customers.
It absolutely is. And you mentioned communication, and you know this. You're in the business of communication, Michael. It is two-way. It sounds to me like the situation you described was pretty much one way, one person dumping information on another person, and it was such a dump that she couldn't even understand what it was. And
sure.
I think that's a starting point, is getting the people inside of an organization, especially the salespeople, but I'm talking people on the shop floor, people who answer the phone, the folks who drive the truck. They represent that brand, and, you know, they represent it in really powerful ways. My co-author Joe Bannon and I have kind of a joke. We say, hey, when companies get in trouble and they damage their brand, it's not usually because they made an advertising mistake or they got the logo the wrong color. It's probably something around a behavior. We can think of some brands. We think of, and I'll just bring it up, things like Penn State University. It's somebody's behavior there a few years ago that damaged that brand. We think of companies who might have an oil spill or they have a product defective. Somebody made a decision inside a company to do something that wasn't good for a customer, and ultimately it blew up. It damaged the brand. If they understood the customer, if they were engaged with the customer, those kind of day-to-day decisions made within the bowels of organizations somehow have a very, very good compass at the center of those decisions, and they start making better and better decisions, and the brand becomes something more than an advertising slogan or a logo. It becomes something that just feels right to those customers out there. And I think that's kind of what you described right there, was a disconnect in your example.
No, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely, 3,000%. Also, too, when you're dealing with the companies, a good question to ask the employees what's your purpose here? You know, who are you here for? And 9 out of 10 of them are going to say, I'm here for me. You know, I get a paycheck or whatever. No, you're here for the customer, because whatever happens with the customer bills. It builds the end result at the end of the month. You get paid more, et cetera. But it's called step away from yourself. And I really believe when it comes down to it, most people get into positions and they don't realize that their language, it's like speaking Chinese to a Russian audience. They have a language and terminology that most of the customers out there don't understand. So it's got to be broken down in such a way that a 12-year-old would get it.
Absolutely. You know, you mentioned something really important, Michael, and that is, what is your purpose? It's really funny. I just had a client in here, a group of very senior people, about 30 of them from across, really, the world. And we spent 2 days saying, why are we here? What is our purpose? And these were the leaders of the company. And to their credit, they recognized that, you know, I'm not so sure we've got that well articulated in a couple of words that then we can take to the people who work for all of our managers and on down the line. And they have thousands of employees, and say, you know what, here's why we're here. And if that feels good and you can get behind it, you know, we love having you on the board, and this is a great place. And if not, we may not be a good place for you to spend all of your waking or a big part of your waking time. And, boy, you really hit the nail on the head, Michael, by saying, you know, it kind of starts with understanding that purpose. And that purpose can drive that brand as well. Very, very important that companies can articulate. You said it yourself in a couple of simple words. That a 12-year-old can understand. Vitally important. Absolutely important.
By the way, Chris, I'm going to give you some magic here. Are you ready?
Yeah.
I've got to ask you two questions. Okay, I've got to ask
you
two questions.
Sure, I will, yeah.
Okay, first question is, what are you selling? Play with me. There's no such thing as a wrong answer. Here's the magic. Here's what most people miss. You personally, what are you selling?
What am I selling? I think I'm selling a better way for people to differentiate their company in the mind of their employees and customers.
Okay, here it comes. This is the first of two. What you're selling is an answer. You're selling a solution to a problem, because it's the only thing that's going to motivate you. And we keep hearing that word solution over and over again. And, you know, but from the time you wake up in the morning till the time you go to bed at night, your entire world is in and around a solution. And let me give you a prime example. I'm going to ask you a personal question. Are you married?
Yes, I am.
Okay, now does your wife fill something up in your life you don't have without her?
You got to give me that one again, one more time.
Does she fill something up in your life you don't have without her?
Oh, absolutely.
She's a solution, isn't she?
Yeah,
your car
of course.
Is a solution. Your house, yes. Your car is a solution. Your house is a solution. How about the telephone you're on right now and the chair you're sitting on? See, your profession, your occupation. All of these things are a solution, or better yet, all of these things are an answer to something. And when a business makes that move, when they realize what they're selling is an answer, that's it, period, end, all of a sudden things start to happen. Okay, second question. Here's the rest of the magic. I'm going to call it a service. What is your service about?
What is my service about? Well, I think the subject matter is brand and culture.
Okay. Now, I'm you. I'm Chris, okay? My book, all right? Ask me what my, and I'm you now, ask me what my service is about.
Michael, tell me what your service is about.
No, I'm Chris. I'm you.
Okay.
I'm supposed to ask you. Yeah. You're the guy I want to reach out
okay.
to, and I'm you. I'm
okay,
Chris.
I'll say, Chris, tell me, what's your service about?
It's about you. See, if it's not about me, I'm not going to listen to you.
Well, you've given me some magic here. I feel like this is great. I'm learning. Thank you for having me on the show. This is great.
Oh, my pleasure. But see, it boils down to that, and it's that simple. You are number one selling an answer, and if it's not about me, I'm not going to listen to you. Recognition is critically important, and I have to recognize myself within the context of what you're talking about. One more quick, and we'll go back to the book. You got me started here. have you ever been to a movie and cried?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, can you remember a particular movie?
I can. Schindler's List.
Oh, okay, there you go. All right, now, do you remember the scene?
Oh, I know. I don't know. I can vaguely see it in my mind, but I'm not sure I could describe it real well.
Okay, well, symbolically, what did it mean to you, symbolically?
Oh, I guess symbolically what that meant was just someone sacrificing at the ultimate level. It kind of made you realize your humanity. I mean, it's a pretty deep thing. So, yeah, it got to me.
Sure. Okay, now, don't answer me personally on this, okay? But
okay,
where was that in your own life? Do you hear what I'm saying?
Yeah.
For that moment.
I want to answer, Dr. Michael.
No. Okay, but that's the audience. That's the consumer. They have to see themselves within the project, the service, the whatever, or they're gone. And I think that's really what it comes down to, and that's so critical with what you're talking about in brand. And it's critical, and when you're talking about it's coming from the inside, you know, from the employees, et cetera, it's very powerful. But the other side is everybody has to know what they're selling and what the service is about.
Yeah, that is beautiful. And I think what you're talking about is driving back into that organization. Hey, there is a customer out here, and we're about them. Boy, that's very, very simple and very powerful.
Yeah, because when you come down to it, there's a tremendous amount of competition out there, and we know that price is not going to do it anymore today. There's got to be that something special where they come to you. There's still a tremendous amount of money out there, Chris. Just people aren't letting go of it as easy. Banks and lending institutions aren't letting go of it as easy as they were, but it's still all out there. There's got to be that compelling reason to buy. And that, I think, is absolutely critical. And the way we find that compelling reason is you go to, you know, 15 or 20 customers that you have, and why me? Why'd you buy from me instead of someone with something similar? And when the common answer comes back, then we, quote-unquote, sell forward with it. Your presentation is on three colors, red, green, and blue. And you ask 15 people what color stimulated them the most. 10 people say blue. Now, you know, two-thirds of your audience want to hear about blue. Next morning, you're in front of a million people. What do you talk about? Blue.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you what, your method is well proven. It's really written about in chapter three of the People Powered Brand. Because we say you talk to 12 to 15 people, and that's really what you need to do. 12 to 15 consumers, 12 to 15 people inside the organization, you can really begin to paint a picture. We use the word insight. You know, there's data and numbers and things like that, but that's a number. We got a 7.2 out of 9 or something. Those are difficult for managers and people to act upon, but our customers care about fill in the blank. That's something that people can react to, and it's using just the method you described, Michael, which is to go out and talk to a handful of people. You know, you mentioned another point I thought was interesting. You know, why buy from us? In the world, and you started out describing a world that's pretty chaotic and a lot going on and hard to figure out this and that and the other. In the world of selling things and branding and marketing, we've gone through some stages and eras. And an era that we're all familiar with is kind of the era of persuasion. My beer is better than their beer, and my car is better than their car, and so forth. But we've really moved beyond that because things are so complicated today. I look at this phone that I've got in front of me. It's got a video screen on it. It's got touchpad and so forth. You could set another one beside it. And to be very honest, I could spend the rest of the day and play with it and couldn't tell you which one was, quote, better. And so the era of persuasion is over because the consumer of anything, I don't care if it's jet engines or a soda pop, that's hard for them to figure out which is best. But what they can tell is, does it do what I want it to do for me? And that's really going back to your point of it's got to be about you, the customer.
Yeah.
And I think we're in an era of utility. Do the things that your company offers. Do for me what it is I want. And that's really what we're trying to tap into, what you're talking about, with the people-powered brand as well.
Yeah, well, let me give you one more before we run out of time, because I think this is extremely important. I'm going to use an example. It's a rough example, so bear with me with it, but the end result is good. You do a presentation. You're all done, live audience, and you're standing there by yourself. One of your audience members comes up, walks out, and calls you stupid. Well, let's say you're the kind of guy that takes offense to this, and then the yelling and the bannering and the noise, and it's pretty loud and it's not too pretty. Okay, scenario one. Scenario two, you and I are sitting down having a cup of coffee, and I'm talking about other guys just like you, same family values, same upbringing, same education, same goals, same across the board. And I'm talking about some of the things that they were doing that were stupid, and you recognize you were doing some of the same things. Chris, there's where the magic is. You can't tell anybody anything anymore. They won't listen to you. So when you frame a third party and they can look at it from the outside in and make the decision with themselves without judgment, there's your persuasion.
Yeah, that's very, very good. And and you're powering it with people's insight from other people. And I think that's just a real fundamental of being a good business and having a good brand and creating a culture that attracts customers is relating to what's out there that you learn and what other people are saying and how they feel about things and using examples like that. That's the magic there. I agree with you.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. By the way, we're just about out of time. We could talk about this for the next 3 days, obviously. So website, we can find you and find the book.
Yeah. Go to peoplepoweredbrand.com. That's where you'll find information about the book. And you can get it on Amazon.com, of course, as well.
Wonderful. By the way, Chris, if anybody missed it, it's up on our website right now so they can come back and find it. And I want to thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
Real pleasure. Love the show, Michael. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Just had to be you. I wandered around, finally found somebody who could make me true, or could make me be or even be glad just to be sad thinking of you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to the Michael Dresser Show. The guest was calling from Hungary, and I guess he didn't make it in. So a very important lesson I learned a long time ago, and it came through a story. So I'm going to take a first-person look at this now. And this isn't me, but it's going to be me in the story. And it's got a point that we really should make. One day when I was a freshman in high school, I saw a kid from my class walking home from school, and his name was Kyle. Now, it looked like he was carrying all of his books, and I thought to myself, why would anybody bring home all of his books on a Friday? He must really be a nerd. And I had quite a weekend planned, parties, football game with my friends tomorrow afternoon. So I shrugged my shoulders and went on. Now, as I was walking, I saw a bunch of kids running towards him. They ran at him. They knocked all of his books out of his arms, tripping him, and he landed in the dirt. Now, his glasses went flying, and I saw them land in the grass about 10 feet away from him. I looked up, and I saw this terrible sadness in his eyes, and my heart went out to him. So I jogged over to him, and as he crawled around looking for his glasses, I saw a tear in his eye. And I handed him his glasses, and I said, those guys are real jerks. They really should get life. And he looked at me, and he said, hey, thanks. And it was a big smile on his face. And it was one of those smiles that showed real gratitude. And I helped him pick up his books, and I asked him where he lived. And as it turned out, he lived near me. So I asked him why I'd never seen him before. And he said he'd gone to private school before now. And I've never hung out with a private school kid before. And we talked all the way home, and I carried some of his books. And you know what? He turned out to be a pretty cool kid. And I asked him if he wanted to play a little football with my friends. And you know what? He said yes. So we hung out all weekend, and the more I got to know Kyle, the more I liked him. And my friends thought the same thing. So Monday morning came, and there was Kyle with a huge stack of books again. And I stopped him and I said, boy, you're going to really build some serious muscles with that pile of books every day. And he just laughed and he handed me half the books. Now, over the next 4 years, Kyle and I became best friends. And when we were seniors, we began to think about college. Kyle decided on Georgetown and I was going to Duke. Now, I knew that we'd always be friends, and even though the miles were there, there would never be a problem. Kyle was going to be a doctor, and I was going for a business on a football scholarship. Now, Kyle was a valedictorian of our class, and I teased him all the time about being a nerd, and he had to prepare a speech for his graduation. And I was so glad it wasn't me having to get up there and speak. Now, graduation day, I saw Kyle. He looked great. He was one of those kind of guys that really found himself during high school. He filled out and actually looked good in glasses. He had more dates than I did, and the girls really loved him. And I got to tell you, sometimes I was really jealous. But today were one of those days I could see that he was nervous about his speech. And he said, hey, big guy, you'll be great. And he looked at me with one of those looks, that the really grateful one, and he smiled. Thanks, he said. And he started his speech, cleared his throat, and began, graduation is a time to thank those who've helped you make it through those tough years. Your parents, your teacher, your siblings, maybe a coach, but mostly your friends. And I'm here to tell you that being a friend to someone is the best gift that you can give them. And I'm going to tell you a story. And I just looked at my friend with disbelief as he told the story of our first meeting, the first day we met. He had planned to kill himself over the weekend, kill himself. And he talked of how he had cleaned his locker out, and so his mom wouldn't have to do it later, and he was carrying his stuff home. And he looked hard at me, and he gave me a little smile, and he said, thankfully, I was saved. My friend saved me from doing the unspeakable. And I heard this gasp go through the crowd as this handsome, popular boy told us all about his weakest moment. And I saw his mom and dad looking at me and smiling, that same grateful smile. And not until that moment did I realize its depth. Never underestimate the power of your actions. With one small gesture, you can change a person's life. For better or for worse, God puts us all here to be in each other's life, to impact one another in one way or the other. So look for that in everybody that you meet.
We'll be right back. Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to the Michael Dresser Show. Our guest, Dr. Donald Bett, MD, is the director. And let me get the engineer to do one simple thing over here. Engineers are good, especially when they do what they're supposed to do. But if they're bigger than you are, you have to be very nice to them. Okay. You get it. Thank you. Donald Bett is the director and founder of Educational Community, EC, a privately funded nonprofit corporation whose mission is to popularize Einstein's solution to prevent human catastrophe and create sustainable peace. The EC offers the first, most comprehensive, scientifically verified self-taught curriculum that explains ANWOT, A-N-W-O-T. Our services are forever free to everyone, everywhere, every time. Dr. Bett acknowledges the influence of Jerome Frank, MD, PhD, deceased, world authority on the causes of war and peace. His favorite mentor while training in psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University in theater. My passion is to inspire ANWOT, A-N-W-O-T, the movement that will allow my 7 grandchildren and other loved ones to enjoy the opportunities that I've experienced, and surely I'm not alone. Donald Bett, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much for being here. Let me ask you this. What was it that got you interested in this in the first place? You know, we talk about peace. It would be so wonderful if we could get everybody on the same page, you know, a level playing field, and to get everybody thinking the same way. But there are challenges to the world. Where was it for you? Where did the light bulb go on that said, this is where you should be, and this is what you should do?
Well, I was fortunate that I had mentors who were very interested in that subject, and my favorite mentor, as you mentioned, Jerome Frank, was at that time the world authority on the psychological issues of war and peace. He wrote a seminal book called Sanity and Survival and was asked to testify before Congress several times. So that's how I got interested. And as you also mentioned, you know, we all love our children. We want our people to do well and survive. And the way the world is going, unless we collectively get our energy together, the way the world is going, there's a good likelihood that our kids aren't going to have the opportunities that we have experienced in our lifetime.
What do we do? What's that first step? Because, oh, my goodness, I don't want to see war. But what is that first step where we can be into the realm of reality and say, we can do this, this works? But, you know, we've got ISIS and we've got people out there that are nuts. Don, I don't know any other way to say it. They're out there killing people, chopping heads off, and obviously we haven't gone to war. How do we deal with something like that? And I say that respectfully because I'm on your side with this. But there's a problem. It's a challenge we have.
Well, a lot of people just give up. They say it's too big of a problem. You know, they say that God will have to take care of it or our leaders or whatever. But so the first step is really to realize that we really can make a difference, that if we get our energy together, that's the only way that we're going to begin to change the way people think. And the basic problem is the way individuals think. We've been brought up with words that divide the world into two categories, where every one of us are given a political symbol, we're given a religious symbol, we're given a patriotic symbol, flags, we pledge allegiance to our side. And that way of dividing the world into two categories naturally leads us to think there's a good side and a bad side. That's the way we tend to think. So one of the first steps is to realize that we are part of the problem ourselves, and we start by asking ourselves, what can we do to make some difference? And the most important thing was told to us by Einstein. In my way of thinking, his most brilliant insight was not the E equals EMC squared formula. It was the understanding that if we're going to save ourselves, we must teach ourselves a newer way of thinking. And that's different than the either way or way of thinking. It sort of is a both and way of thinking. It's me and you together, not who wins, you or me.
Okay, so effectively, how do we get that across? Where do we start that? You know, obviously it's got to have a place to begin. Is it in the schools? Is it in government? Is it where is it that we can get that started? Because I want to touch on this before you answer the question. Politically, there's a lot of money involved, that, you know, and war, there are certain people who make a lot of money when it comes to war. So we have that challenge also. It's being able to take that person, that average person on the street, who's really affected by all of this, we're all affected, but them for the most part, and giving them some kind of voice, some kind of strength to make sure that we can accomplish this.
Well, Michael, I think one of the things we need to do is to try to influence people who are of influence. You're one of those people. You know, the service you provide and the media provides by getting information to the public. My estimate is we have to recruit 1 million, what I call 1 million love creation teachers that will spread the word through the domino effect. One person passes on to the next and the next. That's the way we communicate with other people and make a difference. So it starts by realizing the first step is to change our own way of thinking. And it's really not difficult to do. The formula is really quite easy, but there is such resistance because most people are so tied up in their own present activities. And generally the way people think, you know, is that the success is when you have a lot of money and the big house and so on. They don't think of success as when you're the four things that people really want, that really need. The four things are happiness, unconditional love. We need abundance and we need world peace. We need peace. But if we have unconditional love and happiness and peace, that's the way we have abundance. You get those three, and we will be abundant. Abundance isn't having a lot of money. Some of the wealthiest people that I've met in my practice and elsewhere are among the most miserable. And some of the people who have, you know, feel good about themselves, that's a big difference.
Yeah, see, money in and of itself isn't evil. It's the love of money and taking advantage of someone because of that, yada, yada. I mean, we know that. But the point of contention is that it's allowing people to get the mindset that you're talking about. One of the other challenges we have are what a lot of the kids are being taught in college right now. I mean, it's insane what's going on in some of the places. And, you know, the division that we have in this country today, you know, I've been around a long time, and I've never seen a split the way we are now. And the problem is we get the million teachers, and we can touch a certain amount of people, but then it's called crossing that line to get to the other people who are afraid they're going to lose something if we have peace and love, quote unquote.
Well, that's true. People get established in their habitual ways. When you learn to think of a certain way from the time you're born, and it's not until we're about 18 or 20 that our cerebral cortex, our thinking mind, is mature enough and has a language that we can start to think for ourselves. So we're really like they say, an unwritten on tablet. You know, we're influenced by whatever we're brought up to be. And if we're whatever flags we're given, whatever religious symbols, I mean, if we're taught from early childhood that certain people are good and others are bad and the bad people deserve to be injured, that's the way of thinking that we start out with. So unless we can change that. But, you know, one of the optimisms that I have is that even the most fundamentalist thinkers, that either or thinkers, you know, the women of that society, the women of all societies, still have a biologic desire to see their children thrive and survive. You know, it's just the power we give to the leaders that makes them powerful. When we realize that what we really want is not war, that's when we can get to people.
Now, and I think one of the other problems that we run into today is this. My dad came here in the early 1900s, very early 1900s, and he ended up at Ellis Island. He came in legally and became an American citizen, and he became an American. And I think some of the biggest problems we have now, we have a culture, but we have subcultures within the culture and subcultures within that, and we have people coming here because they're leaving where they lived because they're afraid of getting killed. They didn't like it the way it was, so they come here for freedom, and then they try to make this place like the place that they left. And I really believe if we want peace, we want freedom, there's got to be a set of rules.
Well, there are a set of rules. We know there are universal rules. And religious leaders, secular leaders, and spiritual gurus, you know, they all come to the same rule. It's called the Golden Rule. And if we were to abide by that, teach ourselves that rule, we would get along better. And the modern version of the Golden Rule is a very simple statement. It's, what will make things better for you and me, or my tribe and your tribe, for now and the future? That's sort of a newer version of the Golden Rule. That little rule says we're not interested in blaming anyone, ourselves or anyone else. We're really looking to see how we can cooperate to solve problems. So that one sentence expresses the one standard of morality that virtually every group, religious, secular, and spiritual group, come to. But we don't teach that rule. We do just the opposite.
Yeah, but okay, but let's look at morality, okay? Also, ethics, that's a better word, all right. We have a group of religious people, to the extreme, who believe if the father believes if his daughter looks at another man while she's outside, he can cut her head off, and that's okay. That's moral. That's part of the way the world works. We know that that's not the way that we should be doing things. So you've got different styles of morality, and it's finding the commonality of definition so we can be all moving in the same direction. By the way, please know I'm 3,000% behind you with what you're saying. I'm just bringing up some of the challenges and see if we can work our way through them.
Well, that's the way we'll learn, by bringing up the challenges. You know,
oh, sure.
And I think that's very helpful, actually. But you know what you're referring to, what we think of as this, if this is a personal morality that stems from our biology. Again, it goes back to our ancestors who lived on separate hills, and there was food in the middle of those hills, and in order to survive, you had to be ferocious. You had to be willing to kill. And in order to compete, be part of a tribe, and then to be dominant over the other tribe. So that's been put in our genes over billions of years. So the fact that we all grew up with the idea that we want our way is the only right way, that's part of our biology. And, you know, we've acted that way ourselves in the past. You know, we've set rules where we kill people, and we used to burn witches, because they didn't believe the way we believed. You know, we have religions that have said that if you don't accept our religion, that you can get, let's say you can get benefits in the hereafter if you kill for our religion and so on. But we all start out that way. The point is, we do not educate our public in the common rules. We let people go on with the private rules that come out of our biology. And that's why Einstein, I think, was so brilliant when he said, unless we teach ourselves the way our thinking, whether it's between countries or between tribes or between different ethnic groups or religious groups, as long as we can think the same way, we will always have conflict. That's why we have probably 60 or 70 wars going on right now.
Sure. And you mentioned the word biology a couple of times. You know, biology is a science. So basically, there's a science behind this, and it's all chemical reaction. If you feel threatened, you're going to do what you have to do to make it right and feel safe, the old fight-or-flight mechanism. And basically what goes on is we can give people information all day long, but if they feel threatened in any way, shape, or form, it doesn't have to be physically threatened, but it could be verbally, emotionally threatened, whatever the case may be, they're going to stand up and fight. And a lot of that is changing that biology within the person when they realize that they're not being challenged.
Well, you bring up a good point, Michael, because it's exactly that. You know, if our biology says whenever we're frustrated, the thing to do is to strike out. See, that was adaptive at one time. And what's different today is that we've developed a language, and we have the ability to relate to one another in a social, a cooperative way rather than a competitive way. So unless we teach that, we're not doing it in our schools, and that's essentially what a newer way of thinking is all about. These are very simple skills that teach people to begin to think in terms of the golden rule. The greatest discovery that we've made in history is evolution, because evolution has given us the scientific basis of spirituality and morality. What Darwin and others discovered through the scientific method was that the one driving force that leads us to go from one cell to 50 trillion cells, our complex organism, is reciprocity. Those more complex groups that could relate to one another survived. Those that didn't were cancer cells, they died. And so as long as we are we're dealing with one another as cancer cells, we will continue to fight. Now, the modern expression of reciprocity, if you think about it, is the golden rule. It's do unto others as we'd have them do unto us, and the other example I gave you. So we have a scientific basis now to say, yes, the spirituality and the golden rule is, it's verified by common sense.
But look at what's going on in the schools today. You know, I'm not Christian, but I was brought up, and I happen to be Jewish, but when I was a kid, The majority of the guys that I ran around with, my closest friends, were Italian and Catholic. And, you know, we did Christmas and we did all this stuff in school and sang the Christmas carols and whatever. But they've taken that out of school. And some of the things that the kids are being taught today, you know, anti-America and so on, so we can go on for, you know, a long list with that. It causes them to be defensive. You know, we're arguing things that we shouldn't even waste our time with. You know, we live in a culture today. In this culture, there are areas of the country where you can't say male or female. There are a couple of high schools that are making the unisex bathrooms. I mean, my goodness, it's got to be confusing for kids today.
Well, life has always been confusing.
But we're just
beginning to develop more rationality and more sanity. We're beginning to have the internet. We communicate. We're becoming more. I think our world is becoming more enlightened, and that's where the hope is. So people want to make some changes. These are people. Everybody, they're looking to do something to be meaningful. What they're thinking, what their way of thinking is justified. And that becomes more important to win their point of view rather than say, how can we cooperate so that we all come out ahead instead of a win-lose situation? As long as we pursue this idea that there ought to be a winner and a loser, now that we've introduced weapons that offer no second chance, there is no margin of error anymore. We've got to get it right away. So experts tell us we have maybe at most 8 or 10 years to get our act together. And I'm an optimist. I think if we work together, we can do that.
Sure. Now, by the way, what's the average person? What's something that someone can do to start on their path of creating this world peace? What, you know, the average person, the person who sits down for breakfast with the family, goes to work, comes back, and lives a whatever normal life is anymore. What can they do to literally get something started?
Well, they have to first teach themselves, I think, how to be happy and more loving, first by loving to themselves and then to others. And my solution was Einstein's solution. Learn the 7 really simple word skills, changes that teach us to a different way of thinking, that teaches us to think in terms of both and rather than either or. And there's simple words like I allow instead of you make me, which is a blaming statement. I allow says I take responsibility. I can instead of I can. It turns on our energy factory. We substitute both and for either or. These simple words change the way our energy is directed, and we first start by learning to like ourselves. The first, you know, when you learn to walk, you first got to crawl, and then you learn to walk, and then you learn to run. In order to love others, you start by liking yourself, and then you love yourself with the abundance that overflows to enrich the world. That's another expression of the Golden Rule. Love yourself with the abundance that overflows to enrich the world. When unfortunately, you know, our society tells us that if you like yourself, if you say nice things about yourself, you're being self-centered and egotistical. It's just the opposite of what we ought to teaching individuals. We ought to be saying, when you get up in the morning and you look in the mirror, say to yourself, I am such a hot sketch. I really like myself. Start out the day feeling good and learning to take responsibility for our own good feelings. Then we won't be so dependent on other people telling us we're okay or not okay. Then we can think more independently and go on to the next skills, which are the basic skills that teach us to really like ourselves. And they're just a couple of secret skills on our website that I call emotional self-endorsement. And the other one is the reasonable best test of self-worth. But just very briefly, let me just identify what emotional self-endorsement is. We all know how to talk to a dog to get the dog to shake its behind and wag its tail. We can talk to a baby to get that baby to smile. We go to an athletic event, and we stomp our feet, we yell and cheer. We go to a musical event, and we have tears in our eyes sometimes. They're so enthusiastic, and we applaud. When do we do that to ourselves? You see, we don't take time to applaud ourselves and create the good feelings that we are responsible as an adult to give to ourselves, and our society tells us not to do that. So that would be the first step.
You just hit it. Wait, let me stop you just for a second. You just hit it. We're taught not to do that. And we're so afraid of judgment that we don't live our own lives. And I think that's one of the big problems that we have.
Well, we start out the first almost 2 decades of our life being dependent on others for our life. I mean, we're totally dependent when we're born. And then, you know, we're going to all these, as I mentioned, all these symbols that tell us how to think and how to act. It's not until we're about 18 or 20 that our brain is mature enough that we can begin to start to think for ourselves, and that's when we really ought to start our education, our most important education of self-worth and to be responsible for ourselves. Instead, that's basically when our education ends. We finish high school, and then you're expected to just go ahead and go through life's routine, watching television and being involved with whatever competitive kinds of things, instead of learning to make our life really meaningful and begin to share our goodness, our love, and our happiness with other people. But it starts with ourselves.
Madness. Yeah. Okay.
You know, you
Donald,
point the finger to other people, but
right.
We have the ability to get started ourselves and not be continue to be dependent on other people to say, you're a good guy, or I love you, or your kids did well, or you're driving the right car, or the stock market went up. All these are things that we depend on for our feeling okay, but we ought to be able to take responsibility for ourselves, and it's easy to learn to do that.
Now, no question about it. Now, can we get some of that on your website?
Yes, it's all available on my website, and it's all free. We have three websites, but the main one would be lovingmenow.org, O-R-G, www.lovingmenow.org. And there I've arranged for a local radio announcer, Brad Shepard, who has a beautiful speaking voice, to record 30 skills, including the 7 skills that teach us a new way of thinking and the 2 secret skills that teach us how to like ourselves very rapidly. And everything is free.
Wonderful.
And the idea is people go to that website.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. We're just about out of time, and the website will be up on our website. It's up there right now, actually. So if anybody missed it, they'll know where to go. And then also I want to thank you so much for the work you're doing and spending time with us today.
Well, thank you. You know, you are an agent yourself because, as I say, you're doing the work that needs to be done when you pass the word on to other people. You are the media. You are the influential people, and we need people like you to make these messages available. I thank you.
Oh, and I appreciate that. Okay, take care.
Bye-bye now.
I'm Michael Dresser.
And I am Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is...
It is a wrap.
But I hope for your smile.